It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning the latest developments about yesterday morning's deadly school shooting in Madison at Abundant Life Christian School.
At a press conference last night, Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes named the 15-year-old perpetrator, a female student at the school who killed a teacher and another student. The shooter also died from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. WPR reporter Sarah Lear has been following the story and joins us now for an update on what investigators are learning. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about the victims so far, Sarah?
So there are two people dead other than the shooter. Another student other than the shooter and a teacher died. Police so far have not released their names or ages. They say they're waiting to make sure all family members are notified first.
And for those injured in the shooting, what do we know about their conditions?
As of late Monday, two students were in critical condition, meaning they were in a situation that was considered life-threatening. Six other people, including a teacher, had suffered non-life-threatening injuries.
The police have released some information about the perpetrator, including the name, but it still seems like there are open questions about the motivations.
Yes, absolutely. Police have identified the shooter as 15-year-old Natalie Rupnow, a student at the school. Her first name was Natalie, but police say she went by Samantha, but her motive is still unknown. Police say they're still trying to piece together why she did this.
Turning to emergency response, at one of yesterday's press conferences, Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes said that police had recently practiced responding to a hypothetical scenario that very closely resembled what happened at Abundant Life Christian School. Barnes said this training allowed police to get into the school quickly, that officials from all over the city came to help. Here's a listen.
Our training center is about 3 miles from there. We have special event team medics, those that work with the fire department, responded to this particular scene from their training day. So what began as a training day became an actual day.
Sarah, what else do we know about the first responders arriving at the scene?
So according to the timeline that's been released by the police chief, the 911 call came in at 10:57 a.m. on Monday, and it was actually a second grader at the school who made that 911 call. And according to Madison Police, the first law enforcement personnel arrived within about a 4-minute span of getting that 911 call. Police believe that the shooting took place inside a study hall within the school and that there were students from a range of different grades inside that study hall.
What kind of things have we heard from the school, the parents, and the community surrounding it?
It's a sense of shock, but also kind of dread. A lot of people are saying we hoped it wouldn't happen here, but given the frequency of school shootings, we worried that it might happen here. Abundant Christian is a fairly small school. It's a private school, pre-K through high school with, you know, a couple hundred students. It's been described as a tight-knit community. There is a school official who spoke at a news conference yesterday, who said it's a school, but also kind of like a family.
And we mentioned we don't know the motive at this point behind the shooting, whatever it might be. What are some of the open questions you're still looking for answers on, Sarah?
Well, police have recovered a handgun from the scene that they say was used in the shooting, but it's not clear exactly how a 15-year-old got that gun. Madison police say they're working with federal officials with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to trace the origins of the gun. We do have some information about timeline. We know that the 911 call came in at 10:57 a.m. Officers entered the building within a few minutes, and that by 11:05 a.m., police told people in the school that a shooter was down and a gun had been recovered. Police did not fire their weapons, and they say that it appears that the shooter killed herself. But again, I mean, sort of the exact details, timeline of what happened, when and where is still being investigated.
Sarah, thanks for covering this and thanks for bringing us the latest.
You're welcome.
That's WPR reporter Sarah Lear with updates on yesterday's deadly shooting at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison. If you or someone you know is dealing with a mental health crisis, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Again, that number is 988.
Now to a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists that finds wetlands in the upper Midwest provide billions of dollars in flood mitigation to homes.
The researchers say the next U.S. farm bill is a turning point for protecting wetlands and that industrial agriculture is causing what they call devastating damage to these ecosystems.
Here to talk us through the findings is Stacy Woods, research director for the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and author of the report Wetlands in Peril. Stacy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your report says Wisconsin is home to more than 6 million acres of wetlands. Can you explain the work these wetlands do?
Sure. So wetlands provide so many benefits to all of us. They can help with climate change because wetland trees and plants and soil can trap and store carbon that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere and trap heat, which would contribute, of course, to global warming. In fact, wetlands store 30% of the world's soil stored carbon, which is especially impressive if you consider that wetlands only cover about 6% of Earth's surface. So wetlands also help prevent floods. And this is because the soil and wetlands can act like a sponge and really soak up a lot of water. And the plants and trees in wetlands can create friction and slow rushing waters. So communities really benefit from this natural flood barrier of healthy, intact wetlands nearby.
And you put a dollar amount on the value of wetlands. How much money do we save on flood damage because of the presence of these ecosystems?
So in the upper Midwest, there are 30 million acres of wetlands. And these wetlands provide nearly $23 billion in residential flood mitigation benefits. And that is every year. So over time, that means that these wetlands could prevent between $300 and $750 billion in flood damages. And that's just one benefit in one region. Recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service estimated that wetlands across the United States provide $7 trillion in benefits. And that includes to fishing, to recreation, to water quality, and of course, to flood control.
And the pace of the loss of wetlands is accelerating, you said, over two decades recently. What are the wetlands being replaced with?
Sure. So wetlands face a lot of challenges. We've seen we've lost wetlands to industrial agriculture, which can drain wetlands to convert them to cropland. Industrial agriculture can also dump so much pesticide and fertilizer on the fields, and that can run off of the fields and into our waterways and damage wetlands that way. Other polluting industries like development also can cause damage to wetlands.
How can Wisconsin communities balance that, the need to support farms and to do the farming industry, but also be a good steward to wetlands? How do you strike that balance?
Sure. So I just want to start by saying that there are over 6 million acres of incredible non-tidal wetlands in Wisconsin, including one of the largest intact freshwater wetlands in the entire United States. Wisconsin wetlands provide homes and habitats for so many rare and endangered plants and animals, including migrating birds and local birds. And the good news is that unlike other states in the upper Midwest, like Nebraska, Iowa, and the Dakotas, wetlands in Wisconsin enjoy state protections. And this is incredibly important because these wetlands provide $4.5 billion in flood mitigation value each year in Wisconsin. Of course, Wisconsin has had, some terrible floods recently, like the floods last July that caused states of emergency in four counties. Mm-hmm. But as bad as those floods were, it could have been so much worse without those wetlands to help slow and soak up all that water. And with climate change bringing more heavy rain events, Wisconsin communities will be relying even more on their nearby wetlands to help reduce flooding damage, which is why those policies, like the state policies, are so important. But since agriculture is one of the leading industries that harms wetlands, industrial agriculture especially can just drain those wetlands and convert them or pollute them by runoff. That means that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, is in a unique position to help restore and protect wetlands. And that's why we really were focusing on what the Food and Farm Bill can do. And we were particularly interested in the conservation programs of the Food and Farm Bill. This includes the Farmable Wetlands Program of the Conservation Reserve Program that pays farmers to restore wetlands on their land. And there's also other conservation programs like the Conservation Stewardship Program that helps farmers use soil-friendly farming techniques like cover crops. And this is important because healthy soil on farms is good for plants. It's good for our food. And healthy soil also acts like a sponge, so we can soak up some of those pesticides, some of those fertilizer, which keeps it from being wasted and running off. And so that's how I think we strike that balance, is recognizing how these conservation programs help farmers, help produce good food, and also help our wetlands.
As we wrap up here, looking in your crystal ball, passage of a new farm bill has already been delayed for over a year with contentious issues like climate change on the table. Do you think a farm bill that protects wetlands will be possible?
I'll tell you, you know, the farm bill is supposed to be passed every 5 years, but we're still waiting on Congress to finalize the farm bill. So this is a great opportunity for folks to call their congressional representatives and urge them to pass a farm bill that includes strong conservation programs to help protect and restore wetlands. Because I think this is a bipartisan issue. Mm. Wetlands help prevent flooding. And no matter who you voted for in the last election, no one wants their home to flood.
Stacy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stacy Woods is Research Director for the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, talking with us about her recent report called Wetlands in Peril and how industrial agriculture is a main contributor to the decline of wetlands in the Upper Midwest.
Coming up, a UW-Stevens Point program teaches the science of cannabis plants, including some surprising potential uses for lead and PFAS cleanup.
Our interest started with exploring whether and to what extent these plants can be used to clean up the environment.
Find out more coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. A new program from UW-Stevens Point aims to teach students about the history, science, and uses of cannabis, including ways to use the plant to clean up pollution.
The program will offer three courses to allow students to earn a certificate in cannabis science. The legal cannabis industry is growing rapidly nationwide. A 2022 jobs report found that the number of jobs in the cannabis industry more than tripled over a five-year span.
Two UW-Stevens Point faculty join us for a look at that program. Brian Berenger is a professor and chair of the Department of Biology at UW-Stevens Point, leading the university's new program to teach students about cannabis science. And Shannon Rhea is an associate professor of chemistry at UW-Stevens Point, an instructor in the cannabis science program there. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Brian, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
Brian, give us the basics. Why create this program focusing on the science of cannabis?
Oh, gosh, lots of reasons. Shannon and I are pretty close research collaborators. We started studying cannabis along with a few collaborators. I guess this was back in 2019. We immediately, it was hard to not notice the interest, the high interest levels by our students wanting to get involved in research related to cannabis. And so it was that in combination with looking at the market, looking at the cannabis industry and the remarkable growth in the industry nationwide over really the last five, six, 7 years. And that growth is not showing signs of slowing down anytime soon. And so we see this this is an opportunity at a state university here to sort of meet that industry demand.
And Shannon, you and Brian have worked on various related projects over the years. Coming from the chemistry angle, what is fascinating about this this particular plant?
Just the myriad of chemical compounds that are found in this plant and kind of understanding how they distribute throughout the plant and how we can extract those chemical compounds from the plant and what they can be used for. So from the chemist's end, I'm more or less looking at what happens when the plant is harvested and how we can take the chemical compounds out of the plant and do something with it.
And Brian, coming from the biology angle, obviously plants are part of biology, but what is it about this that you find fascinating as a biologist?
Well, actually, more specifically, I'm an ecologist, and both Shannon and I originally got interested in using cannabis in the process of phytoremediation, which you may know is basically using plants to remove toxins from soil. And much of our agricultural land is polluted with all kinds of different toxins at this point, heavy metals like lead and arsenic and cadmium, and things like PFAS. And so our interest started there. Our interest started with, exploring whether and to what extent these plants can be used to clean up the environment.
Let's stay with that, Shannon, because I hadn't known about this. Can you talk about cannabis as a pollution fix for things like PFAS that we're talking about all the time here on this show?
Yeah, so when chemical compounds are found in the soil, they often get taken up into the plant. And we can start to understand how much and where those chemicals are stored within the plant just by doing some chemical analysis. With regard to PFAS, what we are seeing is if cannabis is grown in soil that's contaminated with PFAS, that PFAS gets pulled up into the various plant tissue, and the size of the PFAS seems to be correlated to how much and how far up the plant it goes.
Now, Brian, take us through the student experience. If I am a student at Point and I'm taking this program, what kind of things am I going to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that we should emphasize right off the bat is that we made the decision early on that this program would be 100% online and essentially asynchronous so that students can work through the course materials more or less at their own pace. I mean, there's some structure there, but we recognize that although we certainly want to cater to the students that are here at UWSP, we also want this program to be accessible to anyone in the world. And that includes, working professionals, people who have families and other obligations. And so our goal was to make these courses accessible, as inclusive as possible, as organized as possible, so that students, whether they're working adults, whether they're traditional college students, can work them around their otherwise busy schedules. And so flexibility is really the name of the game.
We're talking about a new cannabis science program at UW-Stevens Point with Brian Berenger and Shannon Rhea, two faculty members in the college's new cannabis science program. Brian, you mentioned earlier the industry. Now, this is a fairly recent development. There are many legal jobs, at least under state laws in states other than Wisconsin, in the cannabis industry. Can you talk about the demand for people who know this stuff and what you are training people to be ready for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the industry is really remarkable in the sense that it's really just been exploding nationwide, and that's been going on for a number of years. And so one study that I could cite, it's a couple of years old now, but as of 2022, the industry had experienced at least 27% job growth nationally for 5 years in a row. And that's really remarkable. And so that rivals, if not surpasses, pretty much any other industry that you can name, whether construction, business, et cetera. And so the industry is exploding. Yeah, I mean, the legal landscape of cannabis is complex and it's changing on an almost daily basis. Right now in the state of Wisconsin, what we call marijuana, which is high cannabis that has high levels of delta-9 THC is still illegal, but most other forms of cannabis are very much legal with the right licenses here in the state. And much of what we do is grow hemp, which is very low levels of THC. And so, the landscape of the industry the legal landscape surrounding the industry is changing and has been changing for some time. But that has not stopped the industry from growing. And certainly in states around us like Michigan and Illinois and now Minnesota, they are enjoying just astronomical job growth.
Shannon, I can imagine a student thinking, ooh, cool, a pot class. Ah, that'll be fun. And then coming in and be like, oh, no, wait, there's a lot of real science here. Can you talk about the degree of difficulty that might catch somebody off guard?
Sure. So we targeted our audience to the student body that would have at least a introduction college level chemistry and biology course so that we could really get into the details of the chemistry and biology of cannabis. Knowing some sort of, something about the chemical bonding that occurs between atoms and understanding what an element is versus a compound are just some kind of basic level things that you would need to know going into the chemistry aspect.
Now, Brian, of course, many uses of this plant and productions of it, legal in some states, not under federal law, not legal here in Wisconsin. Does that raise challenges for making this happen in the first place, this program, but also for the kind of things you can do and talk about?
I mean, a little bit. It also makes things more interesting, I would argue. And so, I'll emphasize that, everything we do here at our university and in this program is, of course, legal. We have growers licenses through the USDA that allow us to grow. They allow us to grow hemp, which is low THC cannabis with very little psychoactive properties. But there's no doubt that sets up. That sets up challenges for us.
If you don't mind, I could jump in and kind of add to that. I think the biggest challenge with the ever-changing landscape and the legality is just that what we talk about in 2024 may not hold in terms of, certain legislation or if I'm talking about analytical testing, what is approved for proper analytical testing in 2024 might not be the same in 2027. It probably isn't going to be the same across state lines. And so, we'd like to focus sort of more on the general science and knowing that it is going to be a changing landscape. Even when it comes to the research that we might talk about in our classes, because it has been so regulated, the research is in its infancy. So what's known today may change in 3 years because more and more people are going to be able to do research as it becomes more and more legal, and we'll have more information about things like the pharmacology of cannabis.
And Brian, are there changes in federal law, maybe in particular, that would make it easier to do some of the research you want to do?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if what I refer to as high THC, that is high delta-9 THC cannabis, otherwise known as marijuana, once that becomes legal at the federal level, then that will certainly sort of remove some gates that prevent us from doing some of the things that we want to do. But it's worth emphasizing that, whether you're studying hemp or whether you're studying marijuana, it's all cannabis. And you could come here to our university and walk into one of our greenhouses and see our plants growing. And from 20 feet away, you would have no idea if they're marijuana or hemp. They look the same. They smell the same. And so, for the most part, we're able to do the work that we want to do, even though we're focused on low THC strains of cannabis. But once that federal law changes, I think that our lives will become a little more interesting here at the university, because it will open up doors to studying some of the effects of the recreational uses of cannabis, which I think are really interesting as well.
We'll leave it there. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Brian Berenger is chair of the Department of Biology at UW-Stevens Point. Shannon Rhea, associate professor of chemistry there, and they are teaching classes in UWSP's new cannabis science program.
Still ahead, communities around the state put on holiday light display competitions. An Eau Claire enthusiast now runs the local contest. His home display started out as basic years ago.
And now I run a little more advanced controller, and people can pull right up to the house, tune into the radio, and enjoy the lights and sounds.
Turning up the holiday cheer, that's next from Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Communities around Wisconsin brighten the season by putting on contests for the best holiday light displays.
Naturally, some neighbors take it up a notch, going all out to have the biggest and brightest display on the block.
It can be fun to walk and drive by those, and we're checking in now with organizers of two holiday lights contests to find out why these front lawn displays can bring communities closer.
Mitch Mitchell is organizer of the Chippewa Valley Parade of Lights and a veteran holiday lights decorator in Eau Claire. Mitch, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Chad Holfer is here, director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry for the City of Jefferson, which is putting on its fifth annual Deck the House contest. Chad, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Chad, walk us through your Deck the House competition and how these festivities unfold in your region.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, our Deck the House competition is in its fifth year. It was a creation from COVID, ironically. And basically what we do is we encourage communities in our Jefferson County area to decorate their houses, have some fun with it as a family, and then submit their registration online. And then what's nice about it is we take those entries and put it into an interactive map that we share throughout the county and also in the other surrounding areas, and encourage families on their own to visit houses that have decorated their house as part of the competition, where they can compete in three different categories, including our best holiday spirit, most elegant, and the most popular one, the Clark Griswold division.
Can you talk more about that? What does that mean?
If you're a fan like me of Christmas Vacation, the house that you see in the movie is about what some of the participants who enter in that category try to strive for. they are drawing on the grid of the local community with as many lights and displays as they can possibly cram into their yards. Some of them even go as far as connecting their lights to a local radio station. So when you pull up, you turn your lights off and you watch the music tied to the lights. And it's quite it's almost like a fireworks display in the summertime.
Well, Mitch, this is a category you could crush on. I don't think I'm too far in saying that.
Absolutely.
What are the details of the Chippewa Valley Parade of Lights?
Well, as Chad said, ours is very similar to theirs. We're also in our fifth year, but this is my second year running it. It was started by the Park and Recreation Department in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I was actually a participant for the first 2 years, won a few categories, and they decided to just go a different direction with some other events. And I was invited to continue the tradition that they had started. So, like I said, I am in my second year. We have five categories in our competition. We have the best use of lights, most entertaining, most creative theme. We have a judge's choice, and then we also allow the public to vote for a People's Choice Award.
Are you the judge's choice?
I was, yes. Yep.
I received the award for Judge's Choice and Most Entertaining for my display the 2 years that I participated.
And are you needing volunteers in order to do this, or do you really take this on yourself as a community member?
So last year was my first year running it, and it was just my wife and I that pretty much did the whole thing. This year, we did bring a couple of volunteers just to help us. Our prize funds are mostly formed by donations we received from local businesses. So we had a couple people to help us do some advertising, get the word out so we could get some more participants and some more sponsors this year.
Chad, as you organize in Jefferson County at the county level, I'm wondering, how is participation going?
Participation continues to be about the same level that it's been over the last 5 years. What's nice is it seems like every year we always try to expand a little bit further into sections of our county. Right now we have five: Fort Atkinson, Whitewater, Watertown, Jefferson, of course, and then Johnson Creek. And over the years, we've dipped into adding Exonia and Lake Mills and other communities kind of as we go along, to the point where there isn't a major community in Jefferson County that doesn't have some form of participation.
It's almost a little contagious, this this spirit of lights.
You know, it really is. And we... Brooke Francine, who was the original creator of the program, really wanted to try to bring, obviously, families together during a time in COVID where there wasn't as much distraction going on and we could really focus on during the holiday season being with families. And so that has kind of always continued as a theme for this particular program. And it's kind of morphed into a little bit more where we have people in other communities traveling to other parts of the county that they may not have traveled to before. And so now we have this cross-community rivalry. We have people that are traveling and spending money even in other communities when they're stopping and picking up hot cocoa during the night, or they're stopping and getting dinner on an evening. I know for myself, my two children and my wife and I, we get in the car, we get some snacks, our Christmas jammies on, and we actually try to follow and cover as much of the map as we can. So it really has actually turned into a little bit of a family tradition for us.
We are talking about holiday lights competitions in Wisconsin, and that is City of Jefferson Recreation Director Chad Holfer. We also have Mitch Mitchell with us, who is putting together the Chippewa Valley Parade of Lights. Mitch, how did you catch the holiday lights bug? Because you are very much into decorating. Where did this come from?
You know, just from being a kid and decorating the house with my father, it was kind of a tradition that I picked up through him. And we would always, spend a few weeks before the holiday season came around, getting the house all lit up. And it was just something I continued as I got older and, you know, grew with it.
I also understand, I think you have a DJ background, so you can coordinate.
I do indeed, yeah.
Does that help you kind of put the sound and lights together?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different levels depending on a person's experience and a person's budget. I have definitely evolved my display over the years. You know, started out very basic, and now I run a little more advanced controller, and people can pull right up to the house, tune into the radio, and enjoy the lights and sounds.
What are some of your favorite themes that you see in holiday lights displays?
Oh, gosh, it's so hard to pick one, you know, one favorite thing, but I really like the traditional, you know, candy canes and Santa sleighs and Christmas trees.
Where do you stand on inflatables?
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not a fan.
Oh, truth comes out. Chad, how about you? What do you really love to see out there when you're going around and seeing these lights?
I'd say that I like colorful, multicolored lights. I would definitely say that there's some of us, my wife included, who's a traditionalist and a fan of the whites and the reds, and that's a very classic looking Christmas. But I enjoy the multicolored lights. I'd like to see the houses with, you know, we'll get into detail, but the straight lines, the perfectly wrapped trees in their yards. It creates such a curb appeal when you pull up to it that you can just see how much time and effort's been put into decorating a house for the holidays.
I was going to ask you about symmetry and straight lines and how you get that effect and how you view that when you're looking at a light's display.
Well, I would definitely take notes from Mitch if he's got any suggestions, because I don't know how many times I go up and down the ladder trying to get that symmetry just right. And the best thing that I have figured out over the years is to bring in all of my lights a week before I put them up, so that the plastic can be a little more malleable to be able to put in those tight corners and tight areas where straight lines are important. And truth be told, I enjoy seeing lights regardless. And just the amount of technology actually that's expanded over the years has allowed not only houses to be lit, but now you have trees that are having uplighting. You're having more multicolored lights that have patterns to them. It seems like every holiday season, there's something new and fancy going on in the Christmas light industry.
Ooh, new and fancy, Mitch. Give us some of your best tips.
Oh, well, some of my best tips, that's hard to say, is, come up with a plan. I probably spend just about as much time planning my display as I do putting it together, and it doesn't always work out the way I plan in the beginning. But, if you want those crisp lines and you want everything to, be uniform, my house, I'm lucky enough to have it where my yard is completely symmetrical from one side to another. And the way I run my system, it kind of comes in, everything flows in from the center and from top to bottom. But come up with a plan, a vision that you want to see when it's all said and done. And you got to be willing to put the time and the effort in. But still, like Chad said, just anybody who puts lights out, whether it's a couple of strands of lights around the top of the porch or roof or the front of the door, to going all out, decorating all the trees. Either way, it's still nice to see the holiday spirit out there.
Well, Mitch and Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Holfer is Director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry for the City of Jefferson, putting on its fifth annual Deck the House contest. And Mitch Mitchell, organizer of the Chippewa Valley Parade of Lights. They are with us to share about their local holiday lights competitions and how it builds a festive mood in their communities. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.